Good evening. Very welcome here. My name is Erik Berglund. I'm an economist. I'm the director of the Institute for Global Affairs. I'm very happy to be chairing this event tonight, and it's an event that is joint between the Institute of Global Affairs and CPR. And it's an event that launches or celebrates an e-book and a collection of essays on migration. So migration, as you know, has, particularly after the global financial crisis and the refugee crisis in Europe, become not only a European challenge, but also a global challenge. But probably it has been no more dominant than it has been in the European debate, and led to very dramatic shifts in policies in many countries. It has certainly influenced election outcomes, the referenda outcomes around the globe. But it has been a debate that has been, I would say, distinctly void of evidence, or at least the gap between the public discourse and the evidence has been enormous. And very little of a lot of good research that has been done has not really been communicated and informed the debate. And I think this is an attempt this evening is an attempt to show what economics has to say about it. Of course, I think economists would be the first to say that this is not an area where economics or economists have all the answers, by no means. But certainly at IDA we have tried to bring together everyone who works on migration at LSE. Actually more than 50 faculty are working on migration, one aspect or the other. And a lot of the students, and many of you are here, have a special interest in migration and again trying to bring together different aspects. And of course, what we would like to convey is also the total offer that LSE has on migration across the disciplines. And we have tried to also help outside LSE to form what we call an alliance of leading universities on migration, trying to put the research, the massive research that's been done to the policymakers, and try to create a dialogue around the various policy challenges that they face, and both at the national level, but of course also at the EU and ultimately at the global level. As you know, there was in September a UN summit on migration and refugees. There was a special summit that Barack Obama, President Obama, called on migration and refugees. So it's certainly a topic that is very high on the agenda, and we are delighted to have this opportunity to host this launch of an important e-book. We're going to have three presenters. You're going to start, Francesco Fasani from Queen Mary, and also a part of CREAM, which Christian Dustman, who is another of our presenters, professor at UCL, and one of the certainly the leading migration researchers in economics in Europe. And finally, we have Giovanni, who I haven't actually met before, but we are very happy to have you here. And you are in Nottingham, and I think you split yourself between Nottingham and Italy somehow. In any case, we are very delighted to have you here. The way we're going to do it, we're going to have a relatively short presentation, then a little bit of interaction, and then we'll proceed to have three consecutive presentations. Then we have Philippe Legrain, who is, I think, anyone who is interested in the migration debate has seen Philippe's very active, both putting together research, he has put together a think tank on working on on migration as one of their main topics. The think tank Open, and he's been very vocal in the debate in many European countries and a lot of influence. So thank you, Philippe. He's a visiting fellow here at the European Institute as well. So without further ado, Francesco, take it away.
So thank you, Eric, very much. And thank you, everyone, for coming today. Let me see if this works. Yeah, it does. So let me just start by some acknowledgements. I will start by thanking our local host and Eric on my side and on behalf of CPR for hosting the event. Then I want to thank very briefly Charles Wipflos, who is the policy director of CPR, who asked me to try to put together this e-book. Then I will thank CPR staff, Tessa, Nadine, Simran, and Anil for the support they gave me. I cannot but thank all the authors. There are like 28 authors in this e-book, so I will thank all of them for contributing to this volume. And a particular thank you goes to Christian and Giovanni, who are here today to present their chapter, their work, and their research, and their ideas on current migration issues. And I want to thank you also, Philippe, for accepting to be here today as a discussant of the e-book. So this is the...
I should have said that this can be downloaded.
Okay, so I need to...
The only question I have.
Stay close, sorry. Okay, so I'll stay close to the microphone. So why...
Also, that you can download the...
So the e-book can be downloaded from Vox.eu for free. You just need to register and it's there. And so why a CPR e-book on refugees or migration? Because as has been already said, immigration is very politically salient in these days in the political debate and media debate. And so examples which are we all know is the refugee crisis, the Brexit, the US presidential elections. And we can ask ourselves whether, for instance, European citizens are really thinks that immigration is a priority. And we can look at the evidence from the Eurobarometer, where a question is asked about which are the two most important issues that your country face at the moment. And this graph reports data for EU average from 2005 to 2016, showing which are the most important issues. And what we can see is that migration, which is the green line, so here we have concern about economic situation, unemployment, immigration, terrorism. And what we can see is that until the onset of the financial and economic crisis, migration was pretty low. Then you had the financial crisis, which basically all Europeans thought that the main priority was actually, so almost the unanimity of them thought that the unemployment, the economic situation was really the top priorities for the government. And then you have a decline as soon as the economy recovered, and then you see migration piling up. Okay, so it's not anywhere closer here, but if you look at the recent years, 2015, 2016, migration is a major concern. So it's kind of second in average with respect to unemployment. It is very close to that. So European citizens are more concerned about migration than the overall economic situation. So this is kind of interesting. And we can also look at the same data, but instead of taking an EU average, we can look at the same data by member country. And what this graph shows is that is the share of people who respond that migration is a major concern in 2007, 2009, and compared to 2011, 2013, and 2015. So this is the 45-degree line. So if the dots are along the line, it means that there is no variation over time. And if the dots are all above, it means that people became more concerned about immigration. And what you see is that from here is 2007, 2009, people were not particularly concerned about, were more concerned about migration in 2007 than in 2009. And then, as we said before, then there was the onset of the economic crisis, so people got more concerned about other things. So there is basically no change in the concern about migration over time. And then between 2013 and 2015, you do see that all European countries are much more concerned than before about migration. Okay? There is this clear shift above the 45-degree lines. In the circle, there is the UK, which, as you can see, is pretty much an outlier all the time. So the concern about migration has been high in the UK all throughout the entire period. Okay? And this is Christian will say something about this, probably. And as you can see, actually, the UK is anticipating this increase. Okay, so when while the other countries were not really worried about migration, the UK just increased the concern and increased it even more. Okay. So it's a salient issue, and the idea of this ebook, if you want, is that, I mean, this debate, which is all there, which is in the media, which is in the political arena, has not become more deeper or better documented over time. Okay. So what economists can do, I mean, they can provide one view, and actually the economics of migration is a recent field, but it's a pretty active one, and so this ebook wants to reflect this activity. And what economists can say about immigration is try to feed the debate with some facts. And there are lots of facts, lots of interesting findings that scholars in the economics of migration have found, which are worth being disseminated. Okay, so this e-book, the idea is a little bit of doing that. And this e-book, I mean, shows some of the answers that economists found for some questions and then points to at many other important questions. And very briefly, I will fly on this. So there are like four sections in this ebook. We start from refugee migration. Then we look at the literature which has looked at the impact of the immigrants on host societies. Then we talk a little bit about migrants' gains and global gains from migration. And we conclude with different contributions on migration policy and politics. And really, really flying on it. So refugee migration, there are like three chapters on that. Impact, we look at the wage and other fiscal impact in the UK, the impact of skilled immigrants in the US, immigration and health and healthcare, immigrants and crime, education policy and migration. Then we look at migrants' gains and goblin gains from a governance perspective, from the perspective of sending countries, and then several contributions on how migration policy is actually formed. Which is the best immigration policy? What can we do with undocumented immigrants? What's the impact of media? And this is the contribution by Giovanni on shaping policy making. What's the impact on sending society, on democracy and sending society of immigration? And how does immigration affect electoral outcomes? So these are more or less the old chapters in the ebook. So I stop here just to leave more time to the other speakers and I. So I leave the floor to Chris and Dasman.
Okay, thanks, Giovanni. Thanks, Francesco. Too many Italian names. So I didn't really know what I should do here, and I decided that I should perhaps talk a little bit about what I think are... So the debate we are having at the moment is slightly different from what we discussed when we talked about migration over the last, say, two decades. Then, for economists, it was always about the economy, how migration affects different areas in the economy, and how we can measure that, and how we can possibly come up with policy conclusions about the economic impact of migration. However, what we have seen over the past years, and I think Francesco has very nicely illustrated that, is that the whole debate has been becoming very important from a political viewpoint. So the political impact, political cost of what we have been seeing over the last 1.5 years in continental Europe are probably tremendous. The political fallout is very important. And what is changing policy these days is actually not what migration is doing to the economy, but what it kind of has to do with the political sphere. So I think as economists we have to kind of rethink a little bit the way we are looking at economics and possibly, and I think we are in a very good position to explore the political aspects of all that. And so what I want to do in these 20 minutes here is just to take you through that a little bit and point out a little bit the work we have been doing and what I think are the important questions for the future. Before I do that, for those who do not really know much about migration, just to give you some idea about what has been going on over the last 10 years.
Sorry, can you hear us back there?
Yeah. If you don't hear me, just shout.
Okay.
Okay, so immigration used to be a phenomenon of the New World, and when I started working on migration, we always thought about Europe not being a continent exposed to migration, which of course already, 20 years ago, that was not true. However, this entire thing has now changed completely. Europe is an immigration continent, and European countries are immigration countries. Just looking at the numbers, in 1995, 7.9% of the world population, of the population actually in Europe, Northern America, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, were foreign born, and that has increased to 11.2% by 2015, and the tendency is rising. If we look at different countries around the world, and in particular in Europe, we see basically two things which are outstanding. The first is that basically every country in Europe has now a very large foreign-born population. They are very often segregated, like for instance in London, 40% of Londoners are foreign-born. There are other areas where those percentages are much lower. And most importantly, the blue line and the red line I'm showing you here are always apart from each other, with the red line being higher. So immigration has been on the rise in all these countries. The UK is just an intermediate position. Now, one thing people, I think, usually tend to do is to think about migration as a homogeneous phenomenon. That clearly is a huge mistake, not just when thinking about the politics about immigration, but also in particular when talking about the economics of migration. If we look at different countries across the world, migration and the foreign-born population is very different in every country. They are different with respect to education, as you can see in this graph here, with the UK actually being in a very favorable position, given the very large percentage of highly educated immigrants the UK can attract. They are also different with respect to origin. This is just an example. I could do that for many more countries. And they are different with respect to demographics. So immigrant populations in different countries are very different. Now, what are the important questions in the debate about migration? So for many years, and I would think decades, economists were concerned about the economic effects of immigration, and in particular, how we can measure them. How can we measure the impact migration has on wages? How can we measure the impact migration may have on employment? How can we measure the impact migration has on those regions where immigrants are coming from, etc., etc.? That's still an important area, and I think despite the tremendous progress we have made, there are still many, many unanswered questions. Take your time. Okay, are you ready? Okay, sorry, I can't. Now, however, a second issue, which I believe is very important, is the question, how do economic considerations matter for the way people assess immigration policy? How important actually is it that we explore with so much resources what the economic impacts are of immigration if it comes to individuals forming their attitudes or their opinions about immigration policy? Is the economic remit an important one compared to other concerns people have or not? And I want to talk a little bit about that. And together with my colleague Ian Preston, actually, we started to explore that already in the 90s. We were very unlucky with publishing that work because at that moment, nobody cared about that. Now, the other important question is, what are the political effects of immigration? And that's something more and more economists are drawn into over the past years, and I think Giovanni will talk about that. Now, how important is immigration for voting behavior for extreme parties? And particularly, how important is immigration for affecting policies of established parties, which may be a fallout and a cost even larger than voting behavior for extremist parties? So if we look at the spectrum of political parties in this country, the rhetoric of all parties has changed, in my view, quite considerably over the last 6-7 years as a response to the political competition by UKIP at the right side of the political spectrum. And we see very similar developments in other European countries. Now, and then, of course, are the political costs of migration in some way related to economic factors? And do we understand that and can we explore that? So all these last three points are points where research is evolving now and developing, but I think nevertheless very important. So let me talk a little bit about two pieces of research we have been doing. The one is, what drives immigration policies? Can I have my water? Water is a scarce resource at the end of the day, so we share three bottles for five speakers. So one way economists like to think is that the effect of immigration on the economy is actually what shapes immigration policy. Now, you may, however, think that it's not the direct impact of the way immigration affects the economy, but about the perceptions of individuals about how immigration shapes the economy. And much of the debate about we have to bring facts into the debate, we have to tell people what's really going on, we need better research to explain to people... is basically in this graph. Yeah? So that's kind of the understanding or the belief that if only people knew how immigration affects the economy, that immigration is actually not a bad but a good for many countries, then individuals would be completely different in the way they think about migration. Yeah, so that's a very optimistic view. Now, another way to look at that is that it's actually non-economic considerations that affect individuals' attitudes to immigration, and the individual's perception of these non-economic considerations. Now, of course, that is much harder to address and much harder to deal with. And as I said about 20 years ago, with my colleague Ian Preston, we started to explore these things, first with the British Attitude Survey, and then by designing a set of questions for the first European Social Survey in the early 2000s, and I just want to talk about this latter paper very briefly. So the hypothesis we had was that attitudes to immigration reflect a combination of concerns over socio-cultural factors and direct economic impacts on wages and taxes. The key findings, so what we then did is we tried to extract from individuals their beliefs about cultural and socio-cultural factors, which we then related to their attitudes to immigration policy and their beliefs about economic factors to compare the relative magnitude. And we have done that by now for various data sets, and I just want to talk about one paper. So the key finding, and that is reflected in various works we have been doing on that, is that the concern over the socio-cultural factors are far more important in the way they influence individuals' attitudes towards immigration policy than concerns over the impacts on wages and taxes by factor 3 to 5. So let me show you just some results of that. And there are two papers. The latest one has been published in the JEA, so if you want to have a look at it. So one thing people recognized for a long time already is that there is a strong education gradient and a strong age gradient in the way individual attitudes are related to immigration. And I have shown you that here in this graph. So every dot is for a different country, and every dot with a different color represents a different age education. The reference group are reference individuals are on this diagonal line. So these are young, educated individuals. Every time a dot is below this diagonal line here, that particular group has a more negative attitude towards immigration. And what you can see is that the lowest kind of line here are the blue dots. So these are old, uneducated individuals relative to young, educated individuals. And old, educated individuals and young, uneducated individuals are somewhere here in the middle. But this gradient you can find in basically every attitude in the data set. And economists for a long time believe that the reason for this gradient is actually that those individuals who are a bit older and uneducated are in direct competition with immigrants. Therefore, they don't like immigrants. While those individuals who are young and educated are possibly complementary to immigration in a simple labor market model, and therefore they are more positively inclined towards immigration. Now, unfortunately, that's not quite the story which is reflected by the data in our view. So let me just take you through that in a number of minutes. So what we have done here is we designed 60 questions in the European Social Survey to allow us to estimate a relationship which is much more complicated, but to make it very simple, we can think about it as a linear relationship. The linear relationship between attitudes towards immigration or immigration policy related to two factors. The one factor is an economic factor reflecting economic concerns, and the other factor is what we call a social cultural factor, which for instance reflects a concern about homogeneity, concerns about individuals speaking the same language, having the same religion, etc., etc. These factors, of course, are not observed and have to be extracted from the data. So let me just give you the bottom line of that research. We then, of course, so these are the questions which load these factors, and I could talk about them for a long time. Now, this is basically, the key finding. These are just two blocks. I couldn't figure out how to put the standard errors around them, but they are all significantly different from zero. And whatever we do with the data, however we put these sets of questions together, the impact of social cultural concerns, if it comes to whether individuals want more or less migration, is always much larger than the impact of economic concerns. As I said earlier, by factor something 3 to 5. Now, we can look at various other outcomes. So this is what I showed you in the previous graph. This is immigration is good or bad for the economy, and the economic factor here plays a more important role. Immigration makes a country a better or worse place to live, and again, the social cultural factor is far more important. So I have to kind of do that very quickly because I'm running out of time, so let me just give you some other punchlines. Now, remember, I showed you in this graph this gap between educated and non-educated individuals when it comes to favor more or less liberal migration policies. And that gap in the data we used here on average is about 13 percentage points. Now, with the methodology we develop in this paper, we can decompose this gap into a gap which is attributed to economic concerns, which is kind of the conventional view economists had about this, and the gap which is attributed to social cultural concerns. And you can see in this very simple graph here, Francesco goes a little bit. You can see in this very simple graph that the majority of this gap here is explained by socio-cultural concerns. So the educational gradient we find in attitudinal data is mainly driven by socio-cultural concerns. So, let's just look at country variation. We have done that by every single country in isolation, and what you see actually is that for every country in that survey, these are different European countries, except for, I think this is Liechtenstein, the socio-cultural concerns are more important than the economic concerns if it comes to form more or less liberal attitudes towards immigration. Some people believe that immigrants think very differently from natives. Well, that's not the case. If we distinguish between immigrants and natives in our analysis, we find that the gap between economic concerns and social-cultural concerns is shrinking a bit, but also for immigrant populations, the social-cultural concerns, if it comes to assess policies about future immigration, are more important. So what drives immigration policies? From that research and a number of other works we have done on that, we concluded that non-economic considerations are actually very important. And that makes immigration such an incredibly sensitive issue. And that makes immigration an issue which is completely misassessed in the political arena. I firmly believe that the policy of Angela Merkel to open German borders in August 2015, when all these people were already somewhere in Europe, was the right policy. However, the political fallout, the political sensitivity of that particular decision, in my view, was very wrongly assessed. And just to tell you an anecdote, when I went end of that month or beginning September 2015 to a meeting on migration to Brussels, then that was just 2 days after they found the little Kurdish boy on a Turkish beach. I think most of us remember that. And there were lots of junior ministers from different German states who were all very enthusiastic about now we help immigrants, and there is this strong view in Germany that we do the right thing, and this Turkish reaffirmed their views. And I was much more critical about that based on what I have seen in data for many years, and I basically said to them, which didn't go down with them very well, I said, look, this is the dead Kurdish boy on a Turkish beach. The next one will be a German woman raped by somebody who has dark skin, and everything will flip around. And that is exactly what happened 3 months later. So what I want to say with that is the way individuals form their views about immigration and everything which has to do with that is very, very sensitive and very much related not to economic factors, like, for instance, when we discuss trade, we are in the economic remit, but to things which we yet do not understand very well. That's why I think we have to be, and politicians in particular, and the media have to be much more responsible than what we see very often when it comes to deal with this particular issue. So I'm not sure how much time I have. Do I still have 5 minutes? Is that what I have?
Yeah.
So let me point out, let me point to the second thing I was talking about, and that is the political cost of migration. And so many years ago, actually 6 years ago, all my projects take a long time. We started working on something which at the time didn't really raise a lot of interest. And that was, we asked the question how immigration affects voting outcomes. Now there were many papers doing it. But the reason why we asked that question was because we had a particular good design to address that question. We were working with data for Denmark, where over a 10-year period, we had random allocation of refugees to different areas. So if you randomly allocate individuals to different areas, or you have a quasi-experiment, then you don't have the problem that immigrants go to those areas where people actually like them, because they are allocated. Okay? And you can actually deduce from data the causal effect of allocation quotas on voting outcomes. And that was also the period where in Denmark the PP and the DPP became parties which became pretty important on particularly an anti-immigration ticket. So let me just give you some of the results we find in that research. We are covering a period of 3 electoral cycles on municipality and on parliamentary level. Now, over that period, refugee allocation in Denmark has increased from something very close to zero to something like 1% of the population. That's not dramatic, but that is also not small. Okay? And I just have only time to give you some of the punchlines, and I think this is probably the most important finding. So we line up parties from the center left to the center small to the center right to the anti-immigrant parties. And what I've plotted here, this time with standard errors, that's what some research assistant did there, not that I can't figure this thing out here, is basically the effect a 1 percentage point increase in the allocation of refugees has on voting outcomes for any of these party collections. And what you see is that this clearly has increased the anti-immigrant vote, the two right-wing parties in Denmark, and has harmed quite considerably the parties at the left part of the political spectrum. And the effect is actually quite large. So a 1 percentage point increase in the allocation share increases the anti-immigrant party vote share by about 1.38 percentage points, which, given that these parties are relatively small, amounts to something like 16%. And, well, I can talk now about another hour about that. The entire behavior of these parties, where they won in municipal elections, how they behave in these areas is very much related to immigrant allocation. So immigration, at least for Denmark, has been a very important aspect of how these parties actually became powerful. Now, the most interesting thing is when we do the same thing for urban areas, we distinguish between rural and urban areas, the impact is becoming more or less the opposite. So while immigration allocation decreases vote shares at the left and increases vote shares at the right, in 95% of the municipalities in Denmark, which we define as rural municipalities, in the 5% more urban centers like Aarhus, Copenhagen, etc., it seems to have exactly the opposite effect. Why that is, I could again talk about that, and that's also still something we are looking into. But what is important and to take away from this here is that the absorption capacity of different regions within the same country, and I also believe of different countries, if it comes to immigration, are vitally different. Yeah, so that kind of puts in question a little bit quota systems who give everybody and every region exactly the same. But I could talk about that a long time. So let me just kind of wrap up here. Economic concerns, we believe, are not the main drivers of individuals' attitudes and political views towards immigration. Social cultural concerns are far more important, also far more volatile, and far less understood by politicians. Voting behavior is affected by immigration. I believe that immigration in most of Europe and other parts of the world is actually the main lifeline for populist parties. You can see the development of populist parties, which started, for instance, on an anti-EU agenda like the AfD in Germany, and they didn't really take off. And then some smart guy said, okay, no, this is not working. We have to do migration. And then it works. Yeah. So migration, very important for these parties to actually develop, I believe. Now, I also believe that the political costs of all that, at least what we have seen over the last 2 years, are dwarfing any economists and are also much more important in the way we see policies shaped. Voting responses are not homogeneous. So future work, I think, as economists and social scientists more generally, we need to better understand the dynamics of the factors which underlie people's concerns about migration and how these are related and possibly exaggerated by economic factors and by politics, not by policies, by politics. And I think Giovanni will talk about that a little bit. And I do believe that we know a little of how the effects of immigration on policies then translate into economic costs. And to give you an example about that, so if you have a shift in the political spectrum throughout all parties, which becomes more anti-immigration, you at the same time take away the lifeline of the economy to be able to hire talent from around the world. And that has happened many times in many European countries beforehand. For instance, for some years in the Netherlands, the very strong anti-immigration agenda, which shaped the agenda of all other political parties, basically closed the country for the possibility of industry to acquire talent from abroad. We may, hopefully not, but we may see similar developments in the UK. And that really imposes a dramatic economic costs on the country. Okay, so that's it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you were Christian Dustman for a while then. I think we should just invite a couple of questions to before I give the floor to Giovanni. So, anyone who wants to? Yes. Wait for microphone.
Oh, sorry, I speak loud.
No, well, we are recording. So sorry about that. Strategically placed out there. We have good collaboration from the audience. Please, introduce yourself.
Thanks. Says it's turned on.
Speak very close to it.
So, my name's Alex Bryson, I'm from UCL. I wanted to ask Christian about his conception of economics in that European Social Survey paper, because it looked as if you were referring just to taxes and wages, and that's a big part of economics, but I was thinking unemployment and other stuff. So obviously that decomposition is fundamentally sensitive to what constitutes an economic issue and what constitutes a social or cultural one. So I was just interested in whether you've looked at the sensitivity to what actually goes in the economics bin.
So I'll take one more question, and then maybe Christian in the middle.
Adrian, LSE. I wanted to ask you, because you talked about like the sociotropic cultural concern that population have towards immigration. But is that, did you study like the reality? Has immigration an effect on actually the cultural homogeneity of a country, or the solidarity of a country, the social contract or the welfare state? Does it influence that?
Yeah, so maybe the sort of follow-up question to that is, you treat social-cultural aspects as sort of exogenous, as sort of given, what can we do about it, if it's so important? Christian?
Yeah, let me first answer Alex's question.
Well, we have wireless at UCL. So let me first come back to Alex. Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a very important point. So we did a lot about that. Employment is in there, in the results I've shown you. But we have we have used completely different sets of questions to load those factors. And while the relative magnitude always remains the same, but it changes slightly. And we have done that with other data. So another paper with Ian Preston. With the British Attitude Survey, where we look more at racism against economic factors, and we distinguish between different types of economic factors, is kind of showing a very similar picture. Yeah, but of course that's an important point. Now, I really don't know what to answer to that question. There is a big literature in sociology. Putnam and others, of course, have worked on that, and some political economists, Tabellini and others, and I guess probably Giovanni. Knows much more about that than I do. I've worked on social contract, solidarity, and immigration. Now, that literature, I remember we had a big migration conference at UCL in 2013, and we had actually, what's the name of the other guy? So basically, every sociologist working on migration to some extent is now very, very, what's his name? The other. Very big name. I'm very bad with names. I'm bad with names, but I'm also bad with faces. So that makes it very difficult for me to. But so every time I hear sociologists talking about that, they are actually concerned about that. And I think it's extremely difficult to measure the relationship immigration may have on things like solidarity, on things like social contract. Because these are not things which can be, which have a very clear measure. Yeah, we can measure wages, that is a particular monetary unit. But what is solidarity and what is social contract and how do we generate? I think trust is even worse. I'm maybe a little bit extreme, but I find all that. I think we have to be very careful in assessing any of those literatures. And there is some wonderful and fantastic work going on trying to make progress on that, and I think it is important. Nevertheless, these concepts are very often not very well defined, and the relationship between immigration and these concepts, I think my understanding is that we find everything we want in that literature. But I hope we will make progress on that in the future.
Okay, Giovanni, your floor is yours.
Thanks a lot for coming. My name is Giovanni Facchini, and I will basically present a paper which is a part of the book and which builds basically on some of the considerations Christian has actually made. So let me start basically by referring a little bit to the current political debate. So what you look at, if you look at the recent elections in the United States, if you look at what happened on Brexit, you see that fear of globalization played a very important role.
Sorry.
Somebody has moved the slides. Okay. So one thing, though, we need to realize, as President Obama pointed out, is that globalization is a fact, okay? And we are not going to be able to put a wall around this fact, okay? Notwithstanding that, basically, you see President Donald Trump, which has pledged to build a wall along the Mexican border and have it paid for by Mexico, okay? At the same time, he also takes it against trade, okay? He has spelled out a 7-point plan to rebuild the American economy by fighting for free trade. So I was looking at the website and trying to understand what it exactly meant when he thought about fighting for free trade. I am a trade economist, so I think free trade means that you want to liberalize trade. He's not really thinking about that. So he wants to basically negotiate NAFTA, which means basically adding barriers to trade between Mexico and the US. He wants also to use all kind of legal measures to pursue the violators of international trade deals, read anti-dumping, et cetera, against China in particular. Okay, so fear of globalization has really played a very important role in the last election, and Trump has really been able to win basically a pretty broad electoral mandate on those grounds. Now, what we know from the literature Christian has already discussed, we're gonna be flying really through these points, is that when you think about the individual determinants, the determinants of individual preferences towards trade and migration, both economic and non-economic factors play an important role. As Christian has pointed out, when you think about attitudes towards migration, the most of the literature has emphasized that the most important factors are non-economic drivers. When you think about trade, people have emphasized instead the role of economic factors, okay? What I'm trying to do in this paper, together with my co-authors Tommaso Frattini and Cora Sigarotto, is basically to move a step ahead of the existing literature, in the sense that we want to try to link or to study how public opinion affects actual international policy making within a country. So in particular, we want to look at the United States and see how basically attitudes towards trade and migration have affected the voting behavior of elected representatives in the US on those issues, okay? And in particular, our focus is on the role that the media can play in holding representatives accountable to their constituency on those issues. Okay? Basically, what is the underlying, the basic story we are going to be telling? So we know from standard economic analysis, think about the actual rolling model you have studied when you were an undergraduate or you're studying now here at LSE, we know that basically migration and trade should have similar effects in terms of labor market outcomes of workers in destination countries. At the same time, what we know also is that, as Christian has pointed out, that there are important differences when you think about the drivers of attitudes towards migration and trade, because other factors play an important role in shaping them. Okay? For instance, when you think about attitudes towards migration, people have emphasized the role of welfare state considerations, okay? Non-economic factors. When you think about trade, less has been said about. On the other hand, you also know that when you think about the political debate, migration has been much more salient in the debate than trade, okay? And what we want to see basically is whether media exposure on politicians' behavior and can have different effects basically on the way they behave in parliament when you basically consider issues which have different saliency in terms of how relevant they are for the electorate. Okay, so our analysis, as I said, basically will focus on the United States. So we're going to be looking at a bunch of trade and migration-related bills. And what we want to use, basically, what we want to construct, basically, or to use, sorry, is a measure of the exposure of a politician to the media. Okay, so how much scrutiny does the media carry out of the activities of the politician? To do that, what we are going to be using is a paper basically by Jim Snyder and David Stromberg, where they have introduced a notion of congruence between the political district, the district basically in which a politician is elected in the US, and the media market which is served by a particular newspaper. The basic idea of their analysis is that the economic geography factor which shape basically the media market are different from the political geography factors which affect basically the way a congressional district is shaped. Okay? And the result basically is that there is quite a bit of variation between the overlap or in the overlap between congressional districts and local newspaper markets. So just to give you an idea here of what they are thinking about, let's say that we have three districts, this is one, two, and three, and we have three possible newspapers which are serving these three districts. This environment over here is an environment in which we have perfect congruence between the newspaper and the district which is served. Okay, so there is only one newspaper serving one district. Okay, so this newspaper is going to cover a lot the activities of the politician elected in that district. Over here, we have an intermediate situation. There is one district, district number one, which is has congruence equal to one. But then we have two districts, district two and district three, which are served by two newspapers. And each one of these newspapers basically is half of the market. Okay, so congruence here is lower than over here. Okay, and if you move over to this third possible scenario, you have an even lower level of congruence between the district of the politician and the newspaper market. What is the effect? Well, basically, what Snyder and Stromberg argue is that if you look at districts which are more congruent, these districts are characterized by media which cover more in detail the activity of the local congressman, by voters which are better informed, more likely to participate in elections, by politicians who pursue more actively the interest of their constituency. And then also they look at some outcomes, in particular more federal funds flow to the congressman district. Now what we are interested in is not basically, is a specific set of policies, so we are looking at trade and migration policies, okay? So the dependent variable is going to be the voting behavior on trade and migration. The data set we consider is basically carries out between 1986 and 2004. And what we are going to be doing basically is to combine legislative votes on trade and migration with the basically individual voting behavior on these particular issues. We have information on the characteristics of the electoral constituencies, and basically we have information on media coverage, in particular based on the measure by Snyder and Stromberg. So here are the bills we have in our sample. These are basically 13 bills we are studying in detail. And let me just basically tell you a little bit about our key explanatory variable, okay? So key explanatory variables are measures of opinion at the congressional district level on migration and trade. So to this end, basically what we have done is to use the American National Election Survey, which is basically a survey carried out every 2 years in the US, which contains detailed information at the individual level on attitudes towards these two issues. So on migration, basically Hannes asked, do you think the number of migrants from foreign countries who are permitted to come to the United States to leave should be increased, stay as now, or decrease? And on trade, we have a similar question, which asks basically whether you think you should, you should put new limits on imports or not. So what we have done basically is to construct a dummy variable which takes a value of one if you are favorable towards migration, so in other words, you prefer to have migration increased. And the same story comes when we look at trade. Basically, we're going to have a dummy which takes a value of one if you oppose, basically, the idea of introducing new limits. Okay? So then we add, of course, district level characteristics, economic characteristics of the district, and individual level characteristics of the politician. So just to give you an intuition of our results, let's look at these two pictures. So over here, basically, I have a piece, I have Florida, okay? I have two districts within Florida. And what I'm looking at here basically is the link between attitudes towards immigration and the way an individual representative elected in those districts actually voted based on the extent of congruence between the politician district and the media market. So what do we see here? Both these two districts, district number 3 and district number 15, are characterized by average opinions which are pro-migration, okay? What we know is that District 15 is much more congruent than District number 3 when it comes to the structure of the media market. So the local politician will be exposed to much more scrutiny of his actions. And what we see over here is that indeed the politician elected in District number 15 votes in favor basically of opening up migration, this is the bill that we are looking at, whereas the politician elected in District number 3 votes against. Okay, so here you see basically a correlation between the the preferences of the district and the way the politician behaves when basically the politician is actually more exposed to the media scrutiny. Over here, what I have done is basically the same exercise, but looking instead at attitudes towards the state. Okay? Same story, I picked two districts in Texas, in District 9 and District 7. They are both characterized by pro-trade electorates. And District 7 is less congruent than District 9. When I look at the behavior of the politician, I don't see an obvious pattern. Okay, so when I look at trade, basically, I don't see this type of the effect, basically, of higher congruence on the way the politician behaves. And this type of pattern, basically, is what we are looking for in the rest of the analysis. Okay, so our basic analysis is going to be fairly simple. We run a simple linear probability model, where we basically have, on the left-hand side, the vote on migration policy by a politician elected in a district at time t, or the vote on trade policy. We are controlling basically for the average or median attitude towards migration or trade, for the congruence between the district and the media market, and what we're really interested in is this coefficient here, which basically tells us what is the differential effect of opinion, depending on the extent of congruence between the district and the media market. So if we find that these coefficients are positive and significant, that means that basically the official will be more responsive to the opinion of the district, if basically he is more exposed to media scrutiny. Okay, so that's basically the idea. So what do we find? Basically, the analysis is over here. Let me show you just directly the picture because I think the coefficients are less intuitive. So here, basically, what I have is the plot of the marginal effect of the district's migration opinion on the representative voting behavior when I vary the extent of congruence between the media market and the congressional. What I see here when it comes to migration is a clear positive slope. Okay, this is telling us that as the distance become more congruent, the politician pay closer attention to the average opinion of the district when it comes to voting for migration policy. Okay, what happens when I look at trade? Same kind of story, I don't find any pattern. Okay, so that's the basic message you're going to get out of the paper. We've done the Gazzino regressions, this is the basic story. Now let's try to understand a little bit what are the magnitudes involved. Okay, so if I look at two random districts, basically, to give some idea of the numbers, in Florida, the fourth district in 96, congruence is slightly above the average, so it's at 0.44. A 10 percentage point increase in the share of pro-migration individual here leads to a 2.9 percentage point increase in the probability that the representative will support immigration liberalization. Okay? When you look at a more extreme situation, where congruence is at 0.7, in Pennsylvania 5th district, we have an effect which is 7.4 percentage points. Now, let's try to understand what drives this out. Okay, so our basic idea here is to look at the role of election competitiveness. How do we measure that? Basically in various ways. I'm going to present you straight ahead the results in terms of pictures. So we're going to split basically the districts between districts which were won by the politician with a large margin of victory in the previous election, and those districts were won with a small margin of victory. Okay, so the idea basically here is that maybe the responsiveness of the politician to the preferences of the constituency vary depending on how close the race was. And what we find, in fact, is that the average effect on migration basically is completely driven by those districts which were won with a small margin of victory. In other words, those districts which were more competitive for the point of view of the politician, so if he has to basically respond more on the issue to them. So when it comes to trade, on the other hand, we don't find any effect. Okay? We redo the exercise by basically looking at another way of capturing the competitiveness of the election. In other words, we look at turnout rather than at margin of victory. And again, the patterns we uncover for migration are the same, whereas basically we don't see any effect when it comes to trade. Okay, so basically what have we learned so far? That politician seems to be responsive to the preferences of the electorate when it comes to migration, but they don't seem to be as responsive, at least, when it comes to trade. Okay, so now we are economists, so we worry about a lot of identification issues, etc., etc. How much time do I have? First of all,
five minutes.
Okay, yeah. I'll just give you an idea basically of what we have worried about. So in particular, one issue which might come around basically is a concern with reverse causality. Okay, so what would be a problem here? Basically, the idea here is that politicians could influence individual opinion on trade and migration through the local media. OK, in other words, the visitor could shape preferences towards trade and migration by basically the way by basically talking to the local media, and the media then could influence the behavior of individual citizens. Okay. In other words, the effect would be greater in those districts where the coverage of local politicians is actually higher. So what we do here, we do various things. First, we check that the correlation between congruence and opinions is not statistically significant. Then what we do basically is to run an IV, which I think is actually kind of nice, because what we are doing here, basically, we use the standard literature on the determinants of attitudes towards trade and migration, and we use a bunch of demographic characteristics, which we know affect basically the preferences of the individual towards trade and migration. And then we construct basically a predicted value for opinion on trade and migration using basically the standard regression. Our results are reported over in this table, and what you find basically is that the findings we have uncovered in our benchmark specification continue actually. Now, how can I forget about all the robustness checks? I don't think we have the time. A lot, okay. So let me try to tell you a little bit basically what we have done, okay, to summarize our results. So what we've done is to study the direct effect of individual preferences towards globalization on the policy-making process. And we have focused on the role of the media in making politicians more accountable. We have found that individual attitudes towards globalization are strongly correlated with the policymaker behavior only when it comes to migration. And media exposure is important only when it comes to migration. How can this finding then be explained? Okay, so one issue we know is that trade is not very safe. Okay, so that's basically standard. We have information from that from the literature. But what is interesting is that we can also look directly at this type of question looking at our data. So in particular, in the survey basically we are using in the American National Election Survey, there is always a question which allows the respondent to tell us that he doesn't know what is his opinion about trade or what is his opinion about migration. And here basically we have plotted the share of individuals which do not know what they think about trade or they do not know what they think about migration. What is striking from this analysis is that when you look at migration attitudes, people seem to always have an opinion. Okay, only about 2 to 3% of individuals do not have a view on whether migration is good or bad, whether they want more migrants or less migrants. When you think about trade, okay, these are the years basically in which NAFTA was being discussed. Okay, 91, 94 is the period where basically NAFTA was being negotiated. Still, if you look at the American National Election Survey, you have something like between 30 and 40% of the population, of the respondents, assuming it was a representative sample, who did not have a view on what trade was, whether trade was good or whether trade was bad. So it's not surprising then when you think about the role of the media, that the media are able to keep a politician accountable much more on migration than on trade, because people don't really have a clear idea about the effects of trade and whether trade is desired. Now, with the new electoral the result of the new election in the US, maybe this pattern is going to be changed, but at least for the period we were studying in our analysis, this was the case. That's it.
Good evening. That's always a good sign when people start leaving. But it is the graveyard slot. It's nearly 8 o'clock. You're all dying for something to eat or something to drink, and you won't listen to me. Worse than that, I've got a confession to make, which is I am an interloper. I did not write anything in this study. So why am I here? Well, I've been very involved in the immigration debate for about 10 years since I wrote my book, Immigrants, Your Country Needs Them. And now I have set up a think tank called Open. And the idea behind Open is that the new dividing line in politics is between open and closed. And I think that that is demonstrated both by the Brexit debate and indeed by the election of President Trump. And our first study, which I'm going to shamelessly plug, is on how refugees can contribute to the economy.
And if you're interested in getting involved, our website is opennetwork.net. Now, I think it's really interesting because we've had two economists up here, and both of them have been talking about politics. And that is really at the heart of the problem, because I mean, Christian has done fantastic work on the economics of migration, and yet, frustrated as he is, frustrated as we all are, by probably that not having as much impact on policy and on debate as it ought to, is now focusing his work, or at least doing other stuff as well. From my point of view, I think the economics of migration is clear-cut, and I think even that the economic benefits are understated by most economic studies. First, because most economic studies are partial. They look at one bit of the economy, like at the labour market or public finances, and they do so in isolation. And I think that misses the bigger picture. So, for example, if you just look at the labour market and you ignore the economy as a whole, if as a result of migration prices have fallen, then actually real wages are higher and that hasn't been counted in your study. Or if you just look at public finances, let's imagine you get lots of East Europeans coming in and they do jobs that British people used to do. And as a result, British do better paid jobs. Then if you merely look at the contribution to tax and spend of the East Europeans, you're missing the effect that actually British people are doing better paid jobs and therefore paying higher taxes and taking less public spending than before, and therefore you're underestimating the impact on public finances. The other thing is that most economic studies are static. They basically take place in an artificial world where there is no economic growth. And of course, if you only look at two static points and you use basically a neoclassical model, everything basically ends up having as a rounding effect. Nothing much changes because the economy adjusts and you end up almost in the same place you were before. And that's just a complete simplification which allows, you know, policymakers in Britain to argue that actually it's a wash, it doesn't really impact most people's living standards, and therefore we can ignore the economics and focus on the social and cultural. And then you have studies, even those that do try to look at the dynamic impacts, the impacts over time, and they tend to ignore the really crucial stuff. I mean, the dirty secret in economics is that most people are interested in economics because they want to understand economic growth. And yet, the key bit of economic growth, which is where do new ideas and technologies come from, basically economics has hardly any answer to at all. It's just a black box, you call it exogenous. There are a few things that you think, you know, inputs, like let's spend more on R&D, but really they don't have any explanation for the output. And it seems to me that migration, in particular diversity, and it's not just diversity of people from around the world, but deep diversity of men and women, diversity of people with different perspectives, is absolutely crucial. Think if you are in a class and you're trying to come up with the solution to a problem that your teacher has given to you. If all of you think exactly the same, then even if you're absolutely brilliant, you're only as good as that one person. If you are people from all over the world with different perspectives and coming at the problem with looking at it differently, you're more likely to come up with better solutions to problems. And it seems to me, and there are some researchers who are starting to look at that, that is a crucial aspect of what migration brings to the economy. It helps explain why a cosmopolitan city like London is not just so exciting to live in and very expensive, but also somewhere which is, you know, the fulcrum of new ideas and technologies and growth. So economic benefits, I think, are understated. The problem we have is, and Christian pointed out very well, is perceptions. I mean, perceptions are that it's a negative thing, and those perceptions in turn shape a public policy. I don't think there's any economist in the country who thinks that it's a good idea in Britain that we should have a target to reduce net migration to the tens of thousands, let alone that you shouldn't discriminate how you do it, and therefore we should be trying to keep out foreign students, for which there is no political demand. That's purely based on perceptions that migration is bad, a political response to that to say, well, we need to get numbers down, and then, you know, the political bureaucracy taking its turn of implementing that in the most inefficient way possible. The question is, where do these negative perceptions come from. And I think part of it is due to ignorance. If you ask people what share of the population are migrants, they give you numbers which in every single country which are much, much higher than the actual numbers. And if you ask most controversial migrants in most Western countries, which are Muslim migrants, you ask how many of them are Muslim. And again, it's completely off the charts. People think it's much higher. And the same is true of the Brexit referendum. If you ask people how many EU migrants there are in this country, people think it's much, much higher. And Leave voters significantly thought it was highest of all. The second aspect, I think, is misinformation. You know, we're forever being told that we live in an era of mass immigration. And the more you hear politicians say that, the more that you believe it. Now, in Britain, migration in recent years actually isn't particularly high by international standards. The number of migrants in this country isn't particularly high by European standards. In fact, people in this country have a sense that Australia has a really tough migrant policy, and if only we could have a policy like Australia. And actually, the net migration rate into Australia is much higher than it is here in Britain. And then you have misperceptions. And partly these are misperceptions about economics. So there has been a big fall in real wages in Britain and indeed other European countries since the crisis. And many people attribute that to the fact that there's also been an increase in migration, and therefore the two must be correlated. Or if you're an economist, one of the first things you learn is the so-called lump of labour fallacy, the idea that there isn't a fixed number of jobs to go around. Actually, people don't just take jobs, they also create them. And yet, the average person who doesn't understand economics, they think it's obvious. If there's one more person, one more migrant who is doing a job, well, clearly that's one less job for local people. And then I think that there are the broader concerns, which, again, Christian's research touched on. I think they're at the heart of the Brexit vote and, indeed, the Trump vote, which is, you know, there are many white working-class men who've suffered a loss of status. They've suffered a loss of status partly for economic reasons, the loss of good, well-paid manufacturing jobs, and they've lost a loss of status partly due to social factors, for example, the promotion of the equality of women or reducing discrimination against migrants and ethnic minorities. Or the most visible aspect of that, the most keenly felt aspect of that, the easiest bit of that to blame is obviously the migrant aspect, rather than a whole series of changes which have combined to lower your status and which you might feel powerless to do anything about. Or you look, many elderly people idealised the past, not least because they were young back then. And if you look at the Brexit vote, people attribute this as being opposition to migration, but then you look what else the Brexit vote is correlated with. It's correlated with opposition to feminism, opposition to the Green Movement, opposition to social liberalism, support for the death penalty. So it's basically saying, we're social conservative, we don't like the way society has changed, we don't like modern liberal Britain, and the most salient bit of that, and bit you think you might be able to do something about, is migration, and let's vote Brexit. Actually, even if you manage to stop migration entirely, you can't really go back to that world that you wanted to do. So even if politicians are doing what they think they need to do, which is responding to those false perceptions that migration is a bad thing, then they aren't actually going to satisfy the underlying concerns. And last of all, is prejudice. I mean, the number of times you try to have debates with people, and ultimately they are rationalization of an emotional bias. So you see, people will say, when migrants are working, they're stealing our jobs, and when migrants are out of work, they're sponging off the state. When migrants are rich, they're driving prices up, and when migrants are poor, they're driving standards down. Now, as an economist, you can try and look and say, okay, well, what is driving these perceptions, and are they really reasonable, and do they match the facts? Actually, the underlying reason is that people are prejudiced, and that they are construing the facts, whatever they may be, in a negative way. it seems to me then, and something really depressing, because having written a book just trying to make a case for migration based primarily in economics, but also on culture and sociology, and reading excellent books like this, which combines, you know, both analysis of the economics and going further and looking at the politics and the perceptions and so on, is that the depressing thing is that we, as people in the fact-based community, probably don't have much impact on this debate. There is a limit to what we can do. Apart from advising governments to do good economic policies which help to tackle some of the underlying concerns. So, you know, measures to boost growth, which in turn boost wages and create employment, or measures to reinvigorate depressed areas, or measures to ensure public services, the money in public services matches the inflows of people into that area. I think we have to be really honest with ourselves and say we can only have a limited impact on this debate. The final thing, and I think is a reason for optimism, is that at the moment, especially if you are in favour of migration and open societies, it seems like a very dark world. I mean, the election of President Trump in particular threatens, I think, to destroy the open societies and the liberalist national order that we've all grown up in. But if there's a reason for optimism, it's you in this room, which is that attitudes to diversity are strikingly different among young people than among elderly people. If, like me, you grew up in a diverse place, you think that diversity, or you go to a diverse university, you think diversity is normal, and you probably think it's a good thing. It's one of the reasons you came to LSC. And this is not just about rich and poor, because it's the same in poor bits of London. If you see cosmopolitan communities, people have a completely different attitude to diversity to older people. And therefore, if we can at least limit the damage from the terrible things which are probably going to happen in the next few years, the hope is that in future we can have a much more positive, both debate about migration and indeed more sensible policies. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. So, we have a few minutes for questions here, so please, one over here.
Hi. On?
Yes.
Yep. Ruben Lee from a financial consulting group. I'd like to pose a challenge to Philip, which is that you stated that you think that the fact-based community has little relevance in a politically prejudiced world, yet you've created a think tank, which I've only just heard about, forgive me. Presumably, you've created it precisely to change opinions, and so my challenge to you is, beyond the presentation of the facts, which you and everybody else on this panel is seeking to disseminate, I presume that you've got a political agenda as well, because otherwise, in your own words, you won't succeed. So I'd be interested to hear if you wanted to discuss that or at least summarise that.
Okay. So I'll collect a few more questions.
I actually have a question for Giovanni.
And you're introducing, so.
Sorry, I'm Andrew Monate. I'm actually here at the LSC at PhD. I very much like the results on electoral competitiveness, also because I think they explain a lot about the platform that politicians, in a way, use during the throughout, you know, the electoral campaign. And in order also to answer the question of getting the vote out, I think it explains a lot. But do you think also, I don't know if your panel in a way captures what Professor Dussmann was saying about not only the saliency, but also the timing of the events about migration, about the Turkish boy. So how do you answer that? I know like the time dynamics and it's a panel, but how can you account for that?
The female part of the audience. Yeah, wonderful. Thank you.
So I was curious to know if people's attitudes and perceptions about migration differ depending on the business cycle. So are people's perceptions about migration different in good times versus bad times?
Following up on that, I'm Mustafa from here from LFC. It's working? Yeah. Question to Christian. Is there a difference between the perception between economic migrants and refugees? In your other work, you make a very strong point that there should be a differentiation because factors, the drivers are different, policy responses should be different. In people's perception, is there a difference or not?
Okay, do you want to start providing answers? Maybe I'll try this again.
So about the how attitudes change. Now, when we look at that, so in attitudinal surveys, there seems to be a very strong persistence in attitudes. So clearly, as Francesco has shown initially, the relative importance of issues people are concerned about is quite related to the business cycle. But what we have seen, for instance, in the ESS is that there is, well, over the last decade or so at least, quite a persistence in the way individuals in different countries are viewing migration. So the ranking is not really changing over time. although the level may slightly shift, but it's far less dramatic than what we would actually think. So the second question on refugees, and that's actually something we are looking into. And so, when actually quite incidentally, the last refugee crisis we had was in the early 2000s, and that was precisely when we did this set of questions for the European Social Survey, which has been very heavily used. And one set of questions was actually about refugees. But then, with refugee migration, it is always the case that by the time you have done the research, nobody cares anymore. And that certainly was the case in the last crisis. That may be slightly different this time, but this could be very quickly off the table. I mean, in 1 year's time, we will talk again about it. So we never really analyzed that. And we started to actually reanalyze it. And so some very preliminary things come out of it. So if we run very similar models than we do for attitudes towards economic migration, so we don't really have a question which is corresponding to do you want more or less migration from certain countries, which is the question I've been talking about. So for refugee migration, that makes very little sense. But those questions which we have looked at, the pattern is actually not dramatically different. But of course, there is no policy. You see, we always have to understand there is no policy towards refugee migration in the first place. Refugee migration is something which we have committed to under signatories as of the 1951 Geneva Convention for Refugees. So we close our borders, and that's happening. It happened in the 90s, happens now in the 2000s, and it will happen. It is happening right now again. So. The restrictions are becoming tighter and tighter. Germany has completely closed down. But nevertheless, to ask questions which are similar to those for economic migrants is not very meaningful. So we can't really do exactly the equivalent. But non-economic factors in all the aspects of refugee migration, for instance, should you adopt a more altruistic policy? There are sets of questions like that in the ESS. Are again very much driven by non-economic factors rather than by economic factors. Yeah. So going to your point, basically, so the analysis, the data we have basically allow us only to identify preferences towards migration in certain years, because they were not asked consistently throughout all the sample. Okay, so basically what we have is just the years for which basically the question was asked. We try to control for underlying variation basically over time at the state level by using basically state-year interactions, basically. That's as much as we can. Okay.
Yeah, So there was the question for you, Philip. Why do you form a think tank? But I think it goes to a deeper point that I think I sort of posed to Christian earlier. But you know, so we accept that these socio-cultural factors are so important in determining people's attitudes towards migration. But what can we do to change this? And to what extent, you describe them as being kind of latent and not very varying over time. So these are more like values than attitudes. These are things that are seem, at least from what you have described, very stable over time, fluctuations maybe in business cycles and so on. But policymakers, opinion leaders like Philip, what can they do? What can you do to affect these social cultural factors?
I mean, personally, I think that economic and cultural factors often overlap. People who feel cultural factors most keenly might also have economic issues that matter to them, or their attitudes, their cultural attitudes towards openness are partly conditional on whether they think the economy is doing well and the people who are running the economy are trustworthy. And if so, they might not like immigration, but they think it's part of a package deal which is making them richer, and therefore, it's undesirable but ultimately tolerable. And then the economy stops working well, and they lose trust in politicians, and suddenly that cultural value comes to the fore. So I don't think they're necessarily kind of neatly defined separate things. I think that they relate to each other. And I think that's probably something which needs to be explored further. In terms of the rationale for setting up Open, it's because I think it's the defining battle of our time, is open v closed. We are resolutely open, and that means defending and advancing the values of an open society, trying to come forward with persuasive messages and research and proposals to try to affect policymakers and shift opinion, and campaigning on that basis. So is there a political agenda? I mean, yes, it's politics by a different means. I think that it is incredibly important.
Try to answer the same question you have. So one point basically which was made, I think, by Philippe in this presentation was that when you look at attitudes towards migration, the standard survey asked, basically people don't really know what is the extent to which a country has migrants, what is the share of migrants living in a country. They typically tend to systematically overstate, for instance, the number of migrants arriving. So one thing one can try to do is to educate people, basically, or provide information about what is going on. So I want to promote shamelessly a new piece of research we have just finished, running basically an experiment in Japan where we interviewed about 10,000 people, and we provided different pieces of information about the economic advantages of migration. I want to see basically whether that shifted attitudes and preferences towards migrants. And what we find is that this actually has an important effect on preferences, both basically in the short run, but also in the medium run. And furthermore, we find some effect basically in terms of behavioral response. So people are going to actually be more engaged in the debate on migration, be more willing to think positively basically and act positively on migrants if they know more about the advantages of migration. So I think one thing your think tank can do is actually try to put forward informational campaigns about the benefits of migration and try to basically pursue this type of educational campaigns.
I think the economics has been lost a little bit, which partly is my fault. And let me say that I believe that it's absolutely important that we understand the economics of migration, that we understand the impact of migration, that we understand the spillovers, that we understand many of the issues which relate to the decision making of migrants, etc., etc. So that's the fundament of any good policy. What I think wanted to say
by pointing out some of the other work we have done on attitudes, is that, well, the way popular opinion is formed is not really crucially dependent on a complete deep understanding of these issues. But that doesn't mean that policy cannot be or must not be informed by the economics of innovation. So we need to understand that very well. And as economists, we actually have the instruments to analyze that very well. We are much weaker on stuff I have been just presenting, or also stuff Giovanni has presented, because causality is an issue. The concepts are not really clear. We find it difficult to really quantify particular concepts which have to do with trust, etc., etc. We are much better in pinning down the economics of all it. We are much better from the theoretical perspective, from the measurement perspective, and I still believe that this is what we should actually be doing. But we shouldn't ignore the political area as well. And I can see lots of really exciting developments where economists are feeding into this debate, which by now has been really taking off in many other social sciences, such as sociology and political science. But the economics of migration is really, really what we should do 90% of our time.
Well, on that note, so I think even though economics is very important, I think we don't claim that we have all the answers in the migration debate. But I think we have shown here that there are some tools in economics that can help us understand also the political aspects of migration, and also that economists do take seriously the social cultural issues and try to think through what impact they have and what possibly could be done to affect them. So on that note, I want to plug another event that we have next week on the 25th of November. It's a half-day event here called Beyond Tolerance. It's in the morning on the 25th. We will, among other things, we will announce the finalists and the winners of a migration video competition. We had a fantastic response. We went out to together with an LSE-driven startup called Cheney, and we got funding from Open Society Foundation. We got responses from all over the world. Amazing response and some really moving videos. These are just 5 minutes long. You can see the 11 shortlist on our website, right, Sophie? We can. So you go to the Institute of Global Affairs on the LSE website. You can see these videos. And unfortunately, you can't vote there. But we really think that these videos are worth seeing. So with that, thank you very much to CPR. Thank you, Tessa and Nadine. Thank you, Jerry and Sophie. It's been a very nice collaboration, as always. And thank you for coming tonight, all of you. Thank you.